Hello and welcome to Conker's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Steve Tunstall. Steve is the CEO and founder of Insure.com and he's a thought leader when it comes to insurance and insurtech. He's also an ambassador for PanAsia regarding insurance and he's also an author. He's a very busy man and he's now giving up a little bit of his time to share his knowledge with myself and the Conker's Corner global audience. Hello Steve and how are you?
Hi, Peter. I'm great. Thanks.
Now, Steve, thanks ever so much for giving up your time. It's very much appreciated, mate. I know you're busy.
No, it's no problem at all. Happy to do so.
Excellent. So we've been bouncing around a few emails today, and I know that you've been travelling backwards and forwards from Cupertino. Is that how I pronounce it?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, no. So, Steve, I wanted you to firstly start, as I do with most of my Conker's Corner, about firstly your background. I know from what you've said to me earlier that you know you're the son of a miner and you were brought up in North Nottingham. But if you could just go into details for me about your upbringing, college, education, etc.
Sure, happy to do so. I mean,
thank you.
My family and upbringing. I grew up sort of on the edge of a mining community. My dad was a miner for a while, but then he got out of that, which I think he thought was quite clever. And one of the few bits of good advice he gave to me was never go down the pit. So so I didn't do that. And actually, I didn't have any choice because by the time I was leaving school, all the pits had pretty well closed near where we were. So there wasn't that option. It was something that his father had done and he'd done it as well. But he was certainly not in favour of me taking that path. My mother was quite different. My mother was a teacher and she had lots of different ideas of where we could go and what we could do. But things were, I would say there wasn't a huge amount of opportunity where I grew up. There wasn't much in the way of career education at school. And although I stayed on personally and did A-levels, I actually did exceptionally badly at my A-levels and only managed to pass one of them, I'm afraid.
Okay.
So having sort of as an 18-year-old being in that part of the country in the sort of that would have been the early 80s, I guess, there really wasn't a lot to do. There wasn't much in the way of jobs. I mean, I wasn't that well qualified, so I think I applied for something like 150 jobs when I was 18 and didn't even get one interview, so that was fairly depressing.
Yeah, very depressing.
So I ended up going back and doing a sort of part-time course in mechanical and electrical engineering. Had to sort of stay at home. There wasn't any chance of moving out. Managed to get through that, and the first opportunity I got to get a job was quite a long way from home. That was up in West Cumbria. So I worked up there for a little while on construction in the nuclear business. The site up there is Sellafield.
Of course, yeah.
And then I managed to, with the same company, they kindly agreed to put me on a day release degree. So I moved down to Warrington for a little while and I went to Liverpool Poly.
Right,
now it's called John Moores University.
Yeah.
So it turns out it was a university education after all. and I managed to get a degree there. And that was when during that time I was working as a sort of construction manager, contract manager, and I started getting sort of itchy feet of whether I wanted to stay in one job in one company for my whole life. I started to get sort of quite nervous about that, to be honest. So I was looking around at the business I was in and I could see my sort of future mapped out, as I would have been about 23, 24 at that age, and I could see that the managers were maybe 30 and the senior managers mid-30s and the assistant directors were 40 and the directors were 45 and the senior directors were 50, and I could just see, oh my goodness, there's like a production line here, and I'm not sure I can face doing this for the rest of my life.
Okay.
So I it was the first time I jumped ship, and I jumped and went to work for an electrical contractor as a commercial manager for them. Very small company, so I had a lot of responsibility and a lot of things to manage, and a team of about sort of 20 at that stage. Unfortunately, that company went into liquidation, so I jumped to another company, and I at the same time started thinking about setting up on my own. So as soon as the opportunity came, I started my first startup as a consultant working on my own with clients dotted around the country. And that was sort of the first few years, I guess.
So when was that, Steve, when you started your first consultancy? What year was that about?
That would be in the late 80s, so sort of 89, 90, I guess, was the first time I started something up.
Okay, and your consulting at that stage was to do with precisely what niche in that
field? I was doing project management, and for the first time I'd started to get interested into risk management as well. Right. And over the next few years, I quite enjoyed the idea of risk management. It was very much a developing concept at that stage. So there wasn't a lot of formal education, but I quite enjoyed the idea of trying to model and predict the future. That always seemed quite fun. Okay. And I ended up doing some interesting work. I was on the there was a major upgrading of the big motorway that goes through England to Scotland is the M74.
Yeah.
And there was a major upgrading project on that. So working out the risk of, should we start this section before the winter snow sets in, or should we risk it and go for it, and what were the trade-offs of that sort of thing? I always found those discussions quite fascinating, and that was where I sort of got the bug, I guess, for doing a bit more of that sort of stuff.
Excellent. So let's just go back just a little bit. I'm just interested in what you actually did your degree in. What elements of construction were you doing your degree in when you went to Warrington Poly?
I did surveying. That was at Liverpool Poly, yeah.
Yeah.
So I did surveying. Yeah, I'd done a HND before that at Liverpool, at Trent Poly, which I mentioned first, that was in building.
Right,
so then this was in surveying, and then later on I did another part-time, master's in project management as well, so following the theme.
So you were collecting all the different elements of the jigsaw to be able to do all of it at a stage in future then? I think you were planning ahead.
Well, I think I was playing catch up as well. I had this feeling that because I'd sort of underperformed, arguably, at my A levels, and some of my peers had gone off to do full time university degrees, I always felt I was a little bit behind, and therefore always this urge to continually upgrade myself, and.
Yeah.
Always curious about doing different and interesting things, and making absolutely sure I never got stuck in a rut.
Absolutely, that's the way to be, to continually grow and learn. Now, Steve. So after the risk management elements and taking you into the 90s now, and you've finished your work and doing the interested projects, including the M74. What came after that?
Well, then I'd done, because I was in construction, I'd always had some opportunity to travel with my work, and I'd been on a few assignments here and there in Africa and the Middle East and Germany, but very short term sort of things. And I felt it was probably about time. There was a number of other personal circumstances changing as well. I thought, let's go and have a good go at something that's overseas. So I joined. I sort of took a step in the water, and I joined a company that was actually, they were based in York, but almost all of their business was in Hong Kong and Singapore.
Okay.
So that gave me a very good opportunity to visit countries in the Far East and to work on particular projects. Both projects and then commercial disputes. So I got quite involved in some arbitration cases and things like that. And I was loving it. I was notionally based in the UK, but I was never there really. So it really formed in my mind that, okay, this is something I really want to do. One of my clients was one of the largest companies in Hong Kong, a company called Jardine Matheson. And over there, they had a joint venture with a lift and escalator company called Schindler Lifts. And I was doing a lot of troubleshooting for them, particularly solving problems. This would be around the time of the Asian financial crisis, so in the sort of late 90s. And they sort of liked what I was doing, and I ended up basically, even though I was part-time, just about running their operation in the Philippines. For about a year or so, while they were looking for a permanent manager. And at the end of that, they said, would you like to come on full-time, and would you like to be the managing director of the same business but in Singapore? So so I moved to Singapore in, that would be about the year 2000, from the Philippines.
Yeah.
And then I spent the next 4 years as the managing director of Schindler Lifts in Singapore.
Brilliant, brilliant. So you're physically based then, in it, and you're seeing all the things that's going on in Asia. You've experienced what has been the one of the largest financial crises Asia faced as well, with all companies obviously falling amongst themselves.
Yeah, that was a tough time. I mean, it's very difficult now explaining to people in Asia that, you know, 20 years ago, this was not like it is now. I mean, there's been, you know, for people who haven't traveled so much, you probably don't realize quite how far Asia has come. Most of the big cities in Asia are now finished. They're first world cities. They're yes. You know, fully developed. But back in the late 90s, it was you know, every city, as you landed at the airport and took the trip into the city center, you would see lots of projects that had been abandoned, or hotels half built, or, you know, sort of sky trains that hadn't been completed, or overpasses, underpasses that were just, you know, bits of reinforcement bar sticking out of the concrete or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was very vivid that everything had come to a halt. But of course, in the last 20 years, the Asian story has been one of total success and
absolutely, yeah.
a complete turnaround from that time.
Okey-doke. So what I'd like to do now, Steve, is just touch on your leap now then. You're doing all this arbitration stuff, you're doing commercial disputes, you're involved with the lift company in Singapore.
Yeah. Yeah,
what I'm trying to find now your connection and your move across to the Asia side, the insurance side of things, because that's what I know you for. When did that happen? And what was the leap?
Well, I've been doing when I was doing the risk management stuff in the UK, I've been involved in insurance as one of the risk mitigations anyway.
Right.
So that
okay.
was always something that had been there.
Right. Okay.
And basically, by about 2004, 2005, I was finding it really hard being the boss of a company that was being turned around. I mean, basically, that's how Jardines had positioned me, as a sort of turned around expert.
Ah, right, okay.
And that means you're doing, like, you know, 6.5 days a week, et cetera, et cetera. So by about the mid-2000s, I had enough of that, really. So.
Okay.
Again, I sort of jumped ship, resigned from that, moved back to Hong Kong, where I'd spent a lot of time in the late 90s. And in conjunction with an insurance company, I set up a risk management consultancy in Hong Kong. Mm. Did that for a couple of years. Got some big clients over there, some of the bigger banks, Pepsi, people like that. And then one day I went to see Cathay Pacific and did a very comprehensive pitch on the business proposition. There's a few more people in the room than I expected, and we got to the end of the pitch and they said, actually, we don't want the company, but that was your job interview. Would you like a job?
Oh, so, fantastic.
So I said yes, and I became the head of risk and insurance for them, and then went on to be the head of legal and compliance as well. as well as being heavily involved in their crisis management and business continuity management. So,
wow.
So I had a great 5 years there, thoroughly enjoyed it. And of course, yeah, you're buying insurance for an airline, you're buying for a global business. It gets you in, involved in a lot of different things.
Yeah, opens a lot of doors, Steve. Yeah, when you're working with a company of that size.
Yeah, it's a big company, big program, lots to think about, and of course, as usual, not much in the way of resources internally. So you're trying to leverage the external resources.
Yeah. So Steve, when did it come about that you became or co-founded, should I say, the Pan Asia Risk Insurance Management Association, and then also became the Pan Asia Ambassador for International Insurance Society?
Well, it's they came on a little bit off the back of that work at Cathay Pacific. While I was there, there was a good friend of mine who, well, he became a good friend. I only met him at that stage. Frank Baron, who's the chairman of the Pan Asian Risk and Insurance Management Association, he approached me at a conference once and said he was trying to set something up like this, and what did I think? And I basically told him it would be really tough and a fool's errand, and we have to think very carefully about it.
Yes.
And he said, yes, but let's do it anyway.
Yeah.
So he was the driving force behind doing that. And I guess just a year or so after we first had the conversation, I decided I was leaving Cathay and wanted to move. I'd married in the interim and had a couple of kids, and my wife was Singaporean.
Yeah.
And she wanted to move back to Singapore.
Okay.
So third child was on the way, so we decided we'd move back to Singapore, and I got a job as the head of risk and insurance for a company called Resort World Sentosa.
Okay.
Resort World's a very large casino. I think it's the second most profitable casino in the world in Singapore, and it's got massive other interesting things as well. So it's got a Universal Studios on site, 6 hotels,
wow,
the largest aquarium in the world, an adventure theme park, and a museum.
Yeah.
So some really interesting risk management and insurance stuff there again. So something else I could get my teeth into. Mm. And at the same time, you know, I reconnected with Frank, and we set to really trying to pull together the Risk Management Association, which is a not-for-profit, and that's gone extremely well. That's now, we've got now, I think about 1,100 members across 27 countries in Asia. So from a standing start, that's been a roaring success, and Frank was right. There was definitely a need for it.
Absolutely, and that encompasses companies from SMEs up to behemoths, I'm assuming.
Yeah, it's mostly larger companies,
right? Okay.
Because it's only really larger companies that actually have risk managers.
Right.
But no, there are some quite surprisingly small companies who have people who are interested as well, and it's not always the people who have the title of risk manager who are doing the role of the risk manager.
Yeah.
So some of our members are CFOs or general counsels or head of procurement, people like that. It's quite diverse, but they're all in the area of being responsible for the corporate risks of the company, and often buying insurance as well as part of their role.
Okie dokie.
Yeah.
Right. So Steve, at some point or other, I know you mentioned the Asian financial crisis. There was at some point or other, there was an introduction or something that led you into the world of investing. When did that occur for you?
I started first investing in shares when I was back in the UK.
Okay.
So I did a little bit of trading, but it was very ill-informed. It was sort of swayed by the influence of lots of people who I probably shouldn't have been listening to. I mean, I remember one ill-fated investment where I was told this is a dead cert. There was some company, some oil company, I can't remember what they were called now, a very small prospecting company, and I put my money in them, and it did absolutely nothing, and everyone said, oh, it was a complete flop. And then All my friends got out and I just forgot about it. Oh. And then one of my friends called me up and he said, "You'll never believe it. Those shares you bought, they're now worth 100 times what they were when we paid for them."
Crikey.
So I rushed to have a look. And of course, what they'd done is they consolidated all their penny shares. And so it was actually the value of my holding was exactly the same as it was when I bought it in the first place.
So what year was that about then, Steve?
Oh, that must have been mid-90s, I guess.
Mid-90s.
Oh, blast. So I always had an interest in trying to save for my future. Again, it was the – I guess it was the same as the education thing, always that feeling of I don't feel secure. I don't feel that I've learned everything I need to learn.
Yeah.
So part of that was doing the educational bit, and the other part was trying to make sure I was a little bit wise with my finances and put something aside and try to put it into appropriate investments. But frankly, for much of my investing history, I've had a less than stellar effect because of the sort of fickleness of my investing profile over the years.
Okie dokie. So in the 90s, when you first started, you were just looking at essentially tips and reading and friends were influencing you, yeah?
Yes,
But now, and I note in the conversation mentions of emails we've had, that you've got quite a large and significant amount of your investments, other than your businesses, which we're going to talk about, in cryptocurrencies. So where was the introduction to that and when did that start, Steve?
Well, actually, that came from one of my businesses. So
Okay.
Insure is an insurance platform for commercial insurance. So we're building that at the moment.
Yeah.
And essentially that's going to allow SMEs to purchase insurance via a technology platform direct from some of the world's largest insurers.
Yes.
So we're launching that in Asia later this year.
Excellent.
But as part of that, I got heavily involved in the application of blockchain and distributed ledger technology in trying to speed up the whole process and make it more secure.
Yeah.
Because the big issue with most insurance is it's pretty slow and it's pretty clunky. So we were trying to find ways, which we haven't built that into the final product yet, but we're still trying to look at that and how we can speed everything up but improve security at the same time. So clearly that technology is what's underlying Bitcoin, and I got quite interested in what Bitcoin was all about, and frankly I buy into the vision quite a bit of where cryptocurrencies are going, and yeah, frankly, I think in 5 or 10 years, they're likely to be as relevant, and this is a big, bold statement, but they're likely to be as relevant to fiat currency for most businesses, I would suggest. So in my view, I feel it's the right time to be getting into them and getting involved in them. So I've put quite a significant, as you say, part of my personal wealth into various cryptocurrencies over the last sort of 6 months or so, really has been the spike in it, and I feel it's a good way for me to really maximize my growth, but it is of course a very volatile area of investment, and quite frankly, more than a few of the things I've done, it's really on guesswork. Not on knowledge, but if you know that, I mean, from a risk perspective, what I do is I invest in some very small currencies, some small cryptocurrencies. I think there's about 700 now globally, but I just try and sprinkle a small investment across lots of currencies.
Yes.
Rather than concentrating too much, in the hope that if one of them goes, it'll go big, and perhaps the other 9 out of 10 will fall by the wayside, and hopefully that will be compensated by the one that succeeds.
Absolutely. I mean, I must explain to people that individuals that are listening at the moment that Insure, which Steve is a CEO of and the co-founder, is an aggregation solution transforming commercial insurance built on Ethereum, a derivative of blockchain. The platform leverages chatbot interfaces on a mobile-first platform powered by AI and transformed through data analysis. Now, Steve, there's a big... You've got three things going on there. A, Bitcoin and blockchain, Ethereum, and the fourth one, AI, which everyone is obviously talking about now as we go forward with the future of technology, future tech.
Yeah.
So can you... Because I found and started conversing with you over nearly 2 years ago now, when we started covering InsurTech, you know, with insurance, you know, the old lazy boring sort of insurance. Now we've got InsurTech, which is taking these old economies and companies into the 21st century as such. And this is what you're at the forefront of, aren't you?
Yes, and I think without taking issue with what you just said, I mean, I think it's a case of the, you know, the, those big solid companies, they really have an extremely valuable role, and
absolutely,
and they're a great part of the ecosystem.
Yeah.
But I think it's, you know, it's fair to say that all of us would recognise that insurance isn't exactly the most sexy industry in the world.
Yeah, that's probably the better word I should have used. Sorry.
Yeah, and it's perhaps, you know, it's reflective of the fact that there's been, you know, to my view, a certain level of complacency, a certain level of introspection in the industry, and a lack of ability to generally articulate to all of us, not only companies, but to us as individuals as well, that insurance is actually a really powerful thing and a great thing, and we should all, you know, in appropriate proportions, take advantage of that in our lives and our businesses, and make sure that we do have the appropriate protections. Now, what I feel has been happening, there's been a lot of pressure on insurance prices generally over a long period now, and I think that's been reflective in the lack of innovation in the industry. And technology has reached a stage now where many of the functions of that industry, essentially, there's the potential for them to be made much more efficient in the future.
Yeah.
And to help the industry move away from the sort of selling on the basis of fear, which seems fundamentally to be the sales process for so many different parts of the sector, and move to something more, in my view, it has to be a little more impartial. There has to be some clarity and transparency of what's going on. There has to be some proper trust brought back into the process. People feel at the moment that they're just sold the thing that's going to pay the biggest commissions and not necessarily the thing that they need. And I can see that there's a huge opportunity to, you know, rebuild a connection, preferably with technology, preferably through simple and extremely easy to use customer interfaces that really brings home to people again what the true benefits of insurance are. And basically, none of the incumbents were really doing this at all until some small wannabe companies started stirring the whole thing up. To be honest,
Well, I mean, the great thing is, Steve. I mean, I've got a bit of your bio here, and it says that you've been recognised as the number one worldwide influencer in InsurTech according to Global InsTech 1000. You featured in the top 20 global influencers on lots of different lists: Rise, Richtopia, on Elliptica, etc., for InsurTech, FinTech and blockchain. Is that you're at the forefront of this and you're leading the way and people are starting to listen, and lots of other companies now in the insurance field are more and more either buying into blockchain regarding insurance, or going and moving towards the InsurTech side of things to enhance their insurance businesses?
Yeah, I mean, it's an area I've had an interest in for some considerable time, and I've been heavily involved in social media for many years. So one of the reasons I keep bubbling up these lists, I think, is just because I have a very strong following. So
right. Yeah, of course, I guess.
Across the whole of Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram, I think I have about 70,000 followers now. So that's quite a lot of people who interact with me. So when they do these influencer lists, I'm never quite clear on what they really mean, if anything. But clearly, the sheer number of people who are listening to what I say seems to be pushing me up some of these tables, which is nice. But it's also something where you have to sort of try and think about how you be constructive, you be contributing to conversations, rather than anything else. And that's what I enjoy about the interaction on these platforms. I think also, insurance is a great thing. I got a huge fondness for insurance as a risk management technique, and I really feel there's huge opportunities to do things better in the future, and that's why I'm passionate about being involved in this and being involved in the education part. I mean, the big thing about setting up the Pan Asian Risk and Insurance Management Association, the big thing about my role at the International Insurance Society, it's all about giving back through making sure that people are really properly informed about how to take their insurance decisions. And, I've personally put hundreds of hours for free each year into each of these associations to try and drive that message over. And I use social media in the same sort of way to try and educate about the technology and where I feel we could go in the future, and to of course curate information that comes from others. So it's not just my bright ideas. I try and find the best of what's going on globally and try and share that information with others when I can.
Yeah, because I've noticed that when you've been added to and you've led presentations, that the numbers of people that are retweeting and commenting on them are absolutely staggering, really. I'm like, well, there's Steve again, where is he? And you're always in a different part of the world doing something, so it's clear that you're recognized globally, and it's fantastic that you are, because your message is sound and you've got that integrity about you, because you've been doing this now for over 30 years and you've got so much experience from so many different companies that you've worked for.
Yeah. So that's rewarding. I enjoy that, and I'm honored and humbled that people sort of do come back and engage and say thanks for doing that. It was interesting, and that's the stimulus for me to keep doing it, really.
Absolutely. Now I wanted to touch on your book, Steve, Risk and the Asian CEO, that you wrote, and it was published. The latter part of 2016 on risk management. Can you just touch on that a little bit and the reason behind it?
Sure.
And your thoughts?
Yeah, well, this was something that I wanted to put together for some time. So as I've been in sort of Asia over that last sort of 20-year period or so, it's been very conscious to me that there's a particular need to articulate to the C-suite, CEOs, CFOs, etc. in Asia, about how special this period has been for them and their companies. And just because they've been successful through this period doesn't mean that they have a magic wand and they're always going to be successful. So a lot of the theme of the book has been about, trying to firstly, explain to those guys how things like risk management and insurance and crisis management can be applied in an Asian context. And that's a very general term. I've worked in quite a few countries in Asia and they're all very different. But you do find this common theme of quite a paternalistic culture. A tendency still to have a long-term loyal employee base. It's been a spectacular period of growth for pretty well every economy in Asia during this period. So the dark clouds of serious catastrophic risk haven't really shown themselves so much since the Asian financial crisis that we talked about earlier. So a lot of the conversations in my book are about, well, okay, you've been okay so far, but what next? And what can you do from a very practical point of view within your company to make sure that you're building not only resilience into your business, but I'm a big fan of Nassim Taleb, and he talks about anti-fragile. It's sort of how do you make your business actually work better during times of change and adversity? And those sorts of aspects are it's very interesting to talk to, you know, CEOs who've known nothing but sunshine. You know, if you start to talk about what it could be, a bit of rain coming, then they get a different perspective. It's a different viewpoint, and I enjoy those conversations.
Do you think that's you touched on the word complacency there. Do you think there's a lot of that about, not only in Asia, but, you know, across the globe, in the sense of you've been successful 3, 4, 5 years and you think, and certain companies think they've made it and they don't really think beyond what, you know, the glorified sort of sanctum that they've got at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we see that all the time. I mean, there's you know, case study after case study, whether it's, you know, Kodak, Nokia, whatever it is,
because
of your business model, or whether it's, you know, here in Asia, if we look at companies who were affected badly by the Thai floods or affected by the Fukushima incident in Japan. There's all sorts of case studies of where companies are, you know, they feel they've got everything right and they sort of gently but obviously take the foot off the gas a little bit. And then suddenly they're swept away by one catastrophe, or often, you know, when you know, companies tend to be quite resilient if one thing goes wrong, but if two things go wrong at the same time, then that's when you're really sorting out those who've got proper resilience in place compared with those who have really got beyond their means.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things you've touched on there. You touched on Fukushima, but you know, cybersecurity and other risks. There's the other risk where you've got challenger entities for the first time entering the insurance sector. And I mentioned a tweet that you sent out, I think it was going back to the latter part of May. You touched on the intention of Facebook entering the insurance space, you know, using blockchain, AI, etc.
Well, whether they will or not, I think, is a moot point. Yeah. I think it's not clear. I mean, we've seen Google came into insurance sort of very briefly and then went out again.
Yes,
but apparently they're coming back into in India. I was with Google on Thursday actually talking about some stuff on my new business, and they're very interested in the educational stuff of what we're doing at Insure. So they're gonna help us with that, I hope, as we pull that together. But are they interested in getting directly into an old fashioned core business like insurance? Well, I just can't see it.
Right.
But if they ever chose to do so, companies like, you know, Facebook, for example, they've got all that customer database. They've got all those contacts. They've got all that interface right there, right now. And if they chose to move into that direction, arguably they could be very effective, certainly in terms of the intermediary aspects of personal solutions. Would they choose to do so? Would they see it as a core skill? Well, I can't comment on that.
Okie dokie. I mean, you've touched on within the information that you've sent me, you've touched on the fact that you're nowadays, you know, from when you were, you know, buying the odd oil stock back in the 90s, that nowadays you are mostly invested in tech and US ETFs. What sort of tech are you interested in? In the sense of what sectors do these tech companies cover that you are mostly invested in at the moment, Steve?
Well, I'm a bit sort of dyeing the wool in that area. So I love Facebook. Every time Facebook dips, I buy some more if I can. I mean, they're just getting so expensive now that it's quite tricky to do that. I'm a big fan of Warren Buffett's persistence and long-term view and compounding and what have you. So, I mean, he I can't remember which one of his newsletters he wrote in the last couple of years where he said, you know, many investors would be, you know, best suited by just buying ETFs and sticking to it, and the S&P being his preferred one. And I'd already been doing that for a little while, and that's reinforced in me that, you know what, I can't pick stocks brilliantly, and frankly, most of these fund managers who purport to be superb and excellent only give average returns anyway. So if Warren Buffett says keep the fees down and just buy an ETF in the S&P 500 or 100, then that sounds like a pretty sensible strategy to me too, for for certainly some of my investment. Though, as I said, I do buy a bunch of other wild things now and again as well, on the basis that if you don't speculate, you ain't going to accumulate anyway. So I'm not good at taking all of Warren's advice, but I try and take it in part of my portfolio.
Right. So you have a significant side of it, low risk, and then you have a little bit of what I call the spice, you know, the wild side, where you have a smaller portion of your portfolio for higher risk entities.
Yeah, though I must admit, in my case, I think most people will consider at least half of my portfolio as high risk.
Right, okie dokie. So I'm gonna touch on one of the things I like to ask all the time in my interviews, Steve, is when you've got an interest somewhere, what is the criteria that you've done when you're researching these ETFs or researching these companies that says to Steve, I'm going to hit the buy button now?
Yeah, I think it's, again, it varies wildly. And, you know, I mean, you're doing research on an exchange-traded fund. If it's one that's based around the S&P 500 or something of that ilk,
yeah,
then really there isn't a lot of research to do, other than, you know, is this one of the big companies? Is it, you know, Fidelity, yes, or whoever it is, mm-hmm, you know? And looking at the, you know, the track record of that fund, has it been properly managed and properly aligned with the tracking requirements that you're looking for, and just making sure that there's some due diligence around who's running it properly. But it's fairly plain stuff. I mean, it's not high tech. Okay. Then the other end of the spectrum is, I mean, I've been looking very closely over the last 3 or 4 months at investing in various what are called ICOs, initial coin offerings.
Yes, I've seen those. Yeah, tokens. Yeah.
Yeah, and so far I haven't taken the plunge and invested in any of them at the early stage, and Maybe I would in the future. I'm not quite sure, but again, it's, you know, trying to do that due diligence has been part of my decision. And when you look at some of these companies, getting my head around the idea is the first part, and then basically they'll only have maybe a short white paper for you to read, and then you're sort of falling back on the LinkedIn profiles of these guys and trying to guess whether they look like they have the right stuff or not. So it gets very speculative at that point. And I have to say, in terms of taking the plunge and going in early on one of these ICOs, I haven't done that yet.
Okay.
What I tend to do with the smaller cryptocurrencies is let them get past that ICO sort of spike. And then if it looks like they're going to last longer than a week or two, then I'll come in that dip after the first ICO spike and make a small investment then. But I tend to be pretty small beer on those small investments.
Okie dokie. So you're trying to cover a range of different investments with a small amount to see which one will fly, and then add later on maybe if one seems to be doing okay and surviving. Yeah?
Yeah, exactly.
Okie dokie. So with regards to that then, Steve, what's been your greatest lesson you've attained since you started investing?
I would say the old adages are the best. And this was something that, I mean, I mentioned my dad before, and one of the other things that stuck in my mind is something he said many years ago is, you know, if someone comes and tries to sell you something, and I can't remember what the context was now. It was probably in terms of an Amway or something like that, that someone tried to sell him. His comment to me afterwards was, well, why am I so special that this person would come and want to sell that to me? Yeah. of all the people in the city, he's come to sell this to me. Mm. So what makes me the special person?
Yeah.
And I think that's just a great thing to bear in mind whenever anybody comes with a you know, a special opportunity or a once-in-a-lifetime chance. It's like, okay, so why am I the lucky one? And if you can't, you know, answer that question fairly quickly, then the chances are you're not. And in those sorts of situations, you know, if the other old adage is if you can't tell who the sucker is in the deal, then it's probably you.
Very true.
So I tend to be a bit skeptical of it would be wrong to say I'm skeptical of financial advisors, but I am skeptical of people who just seem to be too hard sell. And generally over the years, whether I've taken advice from good people or bad people, I've normally found that if I follow my gut instinct, it's going to be much better than all of them put together, and I pay far less in commissions as well. So that tends to be my approach, that I'll decide for myself what's an appropriate thing to invest in, and then let other people deal with the hard sell stuff.
Okie dokie. So what's been your, taking all that into consideration, Steve, what's been your wisest investment decision to date?
Well, it's probably, frankly, buying Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Right.
I mean, they've just gone crazy this year. And there's a number of reasons for this, but it's actually been a huge personal boon to me over the last few months. So I've done pretty well out of that. I mean, I didn't get right in at the start. I wasn't one of these people who was buying Bitcoin years and years ago. And the same with Ethereum. But I'm very happy with the investments that I've made this year and the success so far. If they carry on like this for a little bit longer, I'll be able to take the whole of my original stake off the table. And then I'll just be left playing with people that, money that's come to me from other people somehow. So that'll be very nice.
Very nice indeed. I mean, there's a friend of mine called Chris Bailey, Financial Orbit on Twitter. I'm not sure if you follow him or know of him, but he's put out an article today, and the value of Bitcoin and Ethereum has exceeded 80 billion, which I found staggering.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's what's even more staggering is it only exceeded 60 billion about a month ago.
I know.
So this stuff is just it's growing like Topsy. I don't know, is it sustainable or not? Very difficult to tell. But at the moment, I'd rather be part of the party, of course, with stuff that I can afford to take a bit of a risk with.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Than be outside of it. I mean, the figures on how these cryptocurrencies have grown in the last few weeks, and even through the last few days or two, has been absolutely astonishing.
Absolutely. I mean, and everyone's querying the reasons why and what's behind it. There's not one perfect answer to round the circle sort of thing to give people the answers either, is there? It's just multifaceted.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, what's very different about these currencies and is that they generally do cut right across the whole of society. So if you look at the way banking as a whole works and the way the whole banking system works, essentially, if you're rich, you get banking for free. So if you're Warren Buffett, you know, he doesn't pay anything to do banking. In fact, banks run after him and pay him money so they can say we do stuff for Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
If you're somewhere in the middle, like you and I, we still pay for banking, but it's affordable. It's something we can manage, but we know we're paying a significant fee for that. And then if you move down the sort of to the less financially fortunate stratas, when you get down to about the first billion people on the planet, banking starts to get prohibitively expensive.
Of course.
And then there's about 6 billion people for whom they're never going to be able to afford old-fashioned banking, I'm afraid. And the banking sector really doesn't seem to care. So So the whole basis of the current banking system is that if you, you know, if you're one of those 6 billion, we really don't care. Now, the good thing about cryptocurrencies is, you know, within a little bit of margin of error, you can move 1 billion Bitcoin for the same price as you can move 1 billionth of a Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter who you are or what you're doing. If you've got access to a device that lets you transfer it, you can get access to all of this.
Yeah, I mean, can I just explain to people that are listening that you're talking about the unbanked of the globe? You know, the people around in remote areas that are unbanked or have not been able to get access to identity that allows them to get banking as well. But if they've got a computer and they've got an account, they can use Bitcoin.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they don't even need a computer. I mean, there's a heck of a lot of this stuff now is starting to just go through mobile devices.
Yeah,
so you don't need to do all this stuff with KYC and all the compliance burden that's required for traditional systems. And I think this is going to, you know, it's changing so quickly. It's changing so fast. It reminds me very much of the mid-90s, and I was talking to – I did a presentation with the British Chamber of Commerce in Singapore on this just a few weeks ago. You know, in the mid-90s, you know, the internet was a sort of dark and horrible place that was only where people – you know, it was for gangsters and porn and things like that. And,
yeah.
You know, the general population never really understood it. And then in 1995, you got the first, you know, TCP protocols were all set up. So you got proper numbers for websites. The same year, America Online switched from a hourly charging structure to a monthly charging structure. I mean, believe it or not, that's the world's biggest, you know, internet service provider. Only switched, it's just 20 years ago. And then by the end of that year, basically the internet became proper because we had the ICANN naming protocols were all set up.
Yes, yeah.
And then it grew like Topsy. And all the people who were saying, well, we're never going to need many websites, are we? They were all behind all the massive growth that happened until, of course, it turned into a huge bubble around about the dot-com stage.
Yes.
And, you know, the point is the business is cyclical. The bubble blew up, but the technology is relentless. And
yes,
out of the back
agreed.
Of that tech came the gaffer. So, you know, Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon.
Yeah.
Now, arguably, we're on the cusp of exactly that sort of situation again, because the discussion I'm now having with people around, well, why do we need more than one cryptocurrency? What's it going to do? And like, so far as I'm aware, there's about 700 plus already. And arguably we're on the cusp of something that's perhaps even more important than the internet, because it's actually going to be the benefit of everybody on the planet, not just those of us who can afford it. So I think there's a huge potential for change. People shouldn't underestimate how fast this technology is growing, and the benefits of added security from having distributed ledger technology. I think we've only just started to touch the surface of how that's really going to change the planet, quite frankly.
And I think you could be right. I mean, it's quite interesting, the tweet you sent out last week, which touched on the fact that Putin, of all people, had endorsed Ethereum, you know, of all things, and saying basically, yeah, I agree with this, with the future of this technology, you know. So
absolutely. And I think this is what, you know, what I think, to be honest, the traditional Western economies have been very slow in this area. And it's partly because you've already got a good functioning banking system, you know, but the when I look at some of the countries that I've been fortunate enough to connect with in Eastern Europe, some of the work they're doing over there is tremendous. And I think, you know, going back to the original point, why is it surging now? So the Japanese authorities have now completely recognized Bitcoin as a legitimate legal tender and regulated it. And essentially what that means is that all the very traditional Japanese trust funds have now swung their attention to cryptocurrencies. And those guys are so big, they've got such a huge amount of ammunition. They only have to divert a bit of their attention to something like this, and of course it's going to get excited. And my gut feeling is that in part it has been some of the trigger for the very recent run up. And and is it hysterical? Is it going to be sustainable? Well, who knows? It's anyone's guess at this stage. But I think what we've seen in the last week or so, that there's a sort of there's a few resistance points have been hit. I can see Bitcoin's bumping along at $3,000 a coin, and I think every time it sort of threatens to go over that, there must be a lot of people who've got sell orders in. And when those go in, the whole market fluctuates again and down it drops. So if it gets through there, then who knows? God knows where it's going to go in the long term. To be honest, it's there's some very wild figures being bandied around.
But, yes, indeed. Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing. I mean, any of these currencies, any of them you look at. Yeah, I mean, so Bitcoin's up 70% over the last month. Ethereum's up 300% over the last month. I mean, these are just phenomenal figures. And you know, anybody who's been around a bit in investing sort of looks at stuff like this and goes, "It ain't gonna last."
Yeah, there's lots of people using the analogy of the tulip mania, you know. And
all
that sort of
stuff.
Well,
the difference with the tulip mania was it lasted about sort of 3 or 4 months, I think, you know, and wasn't based on anything at all.
This is based on
a fundamental change in technology and has been around now for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, that's the people that don't understand exactly what's going on. Like you say, it was the same about the television, the telephone, you know, checks or cash, you know. All the rest of it, and now here we are, and the World Wide Web was, you know, people talked that down for ages, didn't they, before it actually moved on, like you said. So yeah,
exactly.
So there's an opportunity there still, I think, for people to consider that, and especially when you're incorporating it into a business like Insure, which is what you've done, and using AI, the growth opportunities are going to be absolutely phenomenal.
Well, I certainly hope so. I think there's a lot of opportunity to improve some of the older, slower industries. I mean, these industries provide a great service. It's just how do we keep that relevant to younger generations, and how do we help people to access this in a way that's much more convenient and frankly meets their expectations. I mean, this is all about the customer at the end of the day. If the customer's happy with what they've got now, they're not going to change, are they?
Absolutely correct. Yeah, I agree with you there, mate. Now, given the many lessons that you've learned since you started investing, Steve, which one would you most like to share with our listeners that you haven't encapsulated yet in this interview?
I suppose it's that Buffett thing of the power of compounding. You know,
right.
I'm trying now to encourage my kids, and I've drafted a little contract with each of them of them 5 Facebook shares each, and we're watching the share price, and we're watching it going up and down. And I just want to sort of try and inculcate in them from an early age that, you know, you should buy this and you shouldn't just sell it on a whim. You should try and sort of look at, you know, before you buy, look at the long-term potential and stick it out for the long term. And I think as long as you feel comfortable that you've bought something on sound fundamentals, don't go with the sheep, stick to your guns and hold it for the long term.
Cool. Now, just to touch on that, your 3 children, the age range is what?
11, 9 and 7.
So you've started them very early. Good for you. Very well done. Now, Steve, if there's one thing you would change about the investing landscape, what would that be?
I still don't feel there's enough transparency.
Right.
So I feel there's too much flim-flam, there's too much noise. And I understand why that is, and I understand... there are people who are getting advantage from that, so they're going to carry on doing it. But for someone who's trying to learn about investment, it can be quite easy to get misled. So I wish there was a little bit less of that.
Okay. Now, Steve, as you may well know, and you've seen some of my tweets, I do love my books. And you mentioned Nassim Nicholas Taleb earlier regarding his books and Anti-Fragile, and I'm sure you probably read Black Swan. Is there any books that you would recommend for our audience regarding investing or cryptocurrencies or anything that you would say, you know what, I read that and that was a really, really good book that you'd recommend?
Well, I think, I mean, it's perhaps clear from my background that I've always been an entrepreneurial type person. I've always wanted to get out and do stuff. And it's sort of, it's frustrations with working for the people, basically, that drive that. And the, you know, when you have a great boss, it's perfect and you can do well. But if you have a less than perfect boss, then every day can be a nightmare. And I don't see why I should live my life like that. So I've always wanted to aspire to start a company again. And I'm now lucky enough to run and own two. The big thing about this is just the impetus to get on with it and the fact that it really is hard. So I reread again this year, and I think it's the third time I've read it. Probably my favorite book for any sort of difficult task, and whether you're building a company or you're investing, whatever it is and that book's The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. And that for me is just a brilliant book. The story of how you can go through such struggles and difficulties and hardships, and yet you come out with it. And the anecdotes and the advice that he gives in that book, I think, is personally priceless for anyone who wants to start a business or become an entrepreneur, but basically for anyone who wants to be successful in life. There's a heck of a lot of good lessons in there.
Okay, well, thank you for that. It's not one I'm familiar with, so I'll definitely have to give that one a read. Thank you very much, Steve. Do you have another one at all?
Well, I did talk about Anti-Fragile before. Yes, you did, I think, yeah. That's again one of the ones this year that's given me a lot of food for thought. There's a lot of really interesting ideas in there that I haven't seen anybody else really bringing out, and so I'll be going back to that one again and again, I'm sure, because Taleb's such a deep thinker. I have to read most of his stuff two or three times to get my head around it, quite frankly. But it's usually worth the effort.
Well, I've read that book four times now, and there's still things I'm finding out that's new. So my brain's not as big as yours. I have to go back and read it over and over, especially certain passages. I'm like, right, okay, I think I've got that. Then I read something else, something somewhere else. I have to go back and think, I read that completely wrong. I've got a misunderstanding of it.
Some very, very deep stuff there.
I think my problem is I try and read them before I go to bed, and I'm already so tired, you know, so it doesn't help. I have to try and read it again when I'm on holiday next time. Now, Steve, I've covered all my questions. Thank you ever so much for sharing all of your insights and knowledge regarding InsurTech, blockchain, Ethereum, and also the fact, you know, as a serial entrepreneur, as I see you, you know, you're still looking to grow and continue to grow. And, you know, this thing that I've got is about passing it forward. And you're doing that also through all the educational things that you're doing and the charity work you're doing. You know, so as an ambassador for, you know, all things good, absolutely, you know, I just love what you're doing. So, and the fact you're staying humble through all of it as well is absolutely admirable. So thank you for that.
That's very kind. Thank you very much.
You are most welcome, sir. Now, I just want you to know if there's one thing you want to encapsulate the interview with and just share with people. So look, if there's something you want to do, just go out and do it, or something like that. What do you want to close with, Steve?
Well, you know, it's very... Life's tough, but it's also great fun. So if you're doing stuff you don't enjoy, stop doing it.
Yeah. I think you've nailed it there with that one.
That'll do for me.
Oh, Steve. No, that's brilliant. Thank you ever so much. That was Steve Tunstall, CEO, co-founder of InsurTech.com, thought leader, InsurTech leader, risk management leader, all things leader. If you want to learn anything about leadership and the quality integrity needed, follow Steve on Twitter. And that's all I've got to say. Fantastic guy. Steve, thank you ever so much. And we'll hopefully speak again soon, chap.
Thanks. Thanks, Peter. I really enjoyed it. So thank you too for allowing me to do this. And thank you for those who are listening for taking the time to do so.
Okay, Steve. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to you keeping in touch with me and telling me when you're in the UK next as well, chap.
No problem. Will do.
All right. Take care. God bless, Steve.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.